From the campus of the University of Hawaii, this is the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Speaker Series Podcast. Podcasts, video streaming, MP3 downloads, and more are available at cseashawaii.com.
Today's talk, Public Space, Public City, a discussion of the film Dancing in the Park, Hanoi at its Millennium. We're joined here by Professor Mike Douglas from the Department of Urban and Regional Planning, Henry Mochita, who's a doctoral student in the program, and Hao Huynh, who's also a doctoral student in the program.
Very advanced.
Well, we like that. You know, advanced means getting near the end and becoming instructors themselves.
You read between the lines.
Or old, however you
do. No, these guys look like they're doing a good time. As I was just talking with Mike before the talk this morning, they're working on all sorts of innovative and exciting documentary-making procedures and teaching students and working with them in the art of filmmaking for education. And so it's going to really dovetail well with our Association for Asian Studies efforts to bring in filmmakers and film educators from Southeast Asia in the end of March. So we're really excited about hooking everybody up and working in some of these areas. So I think I'll just turn this over to you guys and
great.
Do your magic.
Thanks. Thanks for coming today. What I'm going to do right now is make a very brief, I hope, presentation of what I think is going on in a very big picture way in Southeast Asia. And it's really a competition between the public versus what I call the corporate city, or sometimes called globopolis. And I want to show you some, you know, graphics and explain that. Then we're going to see a couple of films that we'll talk about. Well, actually, Henry will talk about the image. We believe that in between us and reality is the image, and we're presented with images that really are quite compelling in terms of how we understand the city. We are using filmmaking to try to return the image to the people who live in the cities and to move it away from corporate productions of the city. The image of the city. Hao is going to talk about the context of Hanoi and more generally northern Vietnam and why this issue has come up. Then we'll see a couple of films. So, you see, if I point this direction. Briefly, what I'm arguing in a paper that I've written that accompanies this is that over the long sweep of history, the major trend has been for the city to emerge as a public city, as a public realm. Even under the dictator, under the emperor, the claim was that that person was in charge of something that was public. Okay. Now, over the last 20 years, though, we're seeing a sea change. We're seeing an inversion of that, that the city is increasingly becoming a private realm. Not only private in the sense of private ownership, but in the sense of who's building it. Public sector is decreasingly a main player, and increasingly it's very large-scale corporations that are building very large-scale urban infrastructure, housing, and so forth. And we see a challenge to the idea, not only of public space, but of the public city. So that's the theme that we're presenting here. Of course, one of the most important manifestations of public city is public space. A public city must have some degree of public space, and we'll be talking about that. What I've been working on in Vietnam and elsewhere is the idea of livability. What's a livable city? And particularly what we're interested in here is what we call life worlds. This is the missing element. If you look at World Bank or United Nations, they're more in what I call developmentalism. It's all infrastructure, services, functions. Missing entirely from that discourse is the people's daily lives of cities. Once you plug that in, everything gets changed. Who's going to build the city? Who's the city for? Changes very dramatically. So we're looking at what we can call life world, a vibrant city with community, organizations, cultural life, society, people. And it's only very obvious to us that if you want that kind of society, you need spaces for it. And so we're looking at those spaces. So I'm just going to go through typical kinds of spaces that we might be analyzing and studying. One is public streets and lanes, the places where people can enjoy their daily lives. And I don't think there are many more exciting cities in this regard than Hanoi. Anyone who goes to Hanoi even briefly will see the vitality of the sidewalks, the streets, the lanes. These are all happen to be from... These, by the way, are from a photo contest I ran in Hanoi a couple of years ago on local residents giving us photos. And I only had one rule: no tourist photos. The photo must have a meaning to you. And so these are the photos that we got from residents of Hanoi expressing their idea of what is a livable city. Public markets, private markets. This, to me, if you look at this photo and you look at that one, isn't the difference astounding? Just think of the layers. That's got turnstiles, a hired guard, and over here, you'd see nothing like that. So we start to realize there's a whole different social relationship between consumption and citizenship or daily life. And we kind of know why they're doing this. And yet, it's quite striking, the difference. Well, what's happening throughout Vietnam and Southeast Asia more generally is the disappearance of the public market. In Hanoi, I think there are only one or two very large markets left. Despite the fact that surveys show the people of Hanoi want public markets more than supermarkets, but supermarkets are coming to replace the public market. So one can try to date when does the emergence of what I call the corporate city really start, and I tag it around 1985. 1985 was a year, a number of things happened. One was Ndaka, which is the doubling of the value of the yen, and this explosive bubble economy comes out of Japan through Korea and on through the higher income countries to result in the same time happening new innovations and mega projects. And these all come together to suddenly hit the core of Asian cities to redevelop them in huge, huge projects, mega projects. Part of these, so by the mid-1980s, you could have a development project that has billions, not millions, but billions of dollars. And that money could come from the Illinois Pension Fund. It could come from anywhere in the world. The capacity of banks to mobilize huge amounts of capital really comes to fruition in the late 1980s. You have, at the same time, in Asian cities, an affluent middle class that wants these kinds of places, that wants the huge mega mall and all that stuff. Now we can build buildings that are over 150 stories tall. And sometimes people say, why are you building them? They say, because we can. The technology is there. Well, there's a whole politics. Once you start a mega project, it doesn't matter whether it's making money or not. And in fact, there's no way to make a feasibility study of a very large project. It's just simply a finger in the wind. So there's a lot of politics that go on to it. But what I like to point out, one of the main drivers of creating these huge projects is actually intercity competition for global investment. All cities are told that you are poor, you must compete, and you must get international capital or global capital into you. And particularly, you must create your city as a world city. If you cannot gain the status of a world city, you're nowhere. And your whole economy is destined to go down. So, here is one of the first episodes in which I saw the privatization of the city really come unabashedly, even positively forced. It says, this is Mong Tong Thani outside of Bangkok. It's now mostly a ghost town because it went bankrupt. But here, this was in a newspaper, I think it was a Bangkok Post or something, full page advertisement. We have all the intentions to develop Mong Tong Thani as a complete city run by private sector people. a complete city run by private sector people.
It was not a stroke of genius, it was logic.
What's that logic?
Well, this means that there's no government. Right? If you have a problem, you go to management. And that management might not be in your country, actually. So what happens, this is being built, this is it. It still stands there, but most of these are totally empty. Here's a guy, at last he can go fishing again, because it's totally empty. Well, in some of these buildings there are actually tenants, and there were people who were trying to make businesses. They were abandoned by the owners of this place. They kept electricity going, the electricity going and the sewerage going, that's all. No other responsibility, no other forum you could go to complain, what happened to my city? The management's bankrupt, and that's it. In fact, still in Bangkok, this is now more than 10 years after the crisis, this falls apart in the 1998 crisis, you can still see dotted all over the city these empty shells of buildings that have just been abandoned. You can now see that in the United States of abandoned shopping malls, big box stores at the edge of cities. Get online, look at it. It's a kind of, it's a very spooky, frightening thing to look at. All right. This is a long list of things. Perhaps we can talk about it later. I won't go through it all. But I'm trying to compare what is the difference between the idea of the public city and the idea of the corporate city. And I have these indicators. So, on one hand, the public city is about civitas, about the idea of the city has private spaces in it, but it's generally a public sphere that we can make decisions about. The other is simply, it's a private, for-profit enterprise. The city is nothing more than a business, nothing more than a corporation. And so you get a whole host of things that follow from that. Now, what's coming in terms of the built environment with the corporate city? One of them, the elements, is the world's tallest buildings. It's quite amazing. If you go to Europe, there are very few huge, tall buildings. They don't need them in Europe. In Asia, I think 25 of the tallest 35 buildings in the world are in East and Southeast Asia. And when one is built, the next country competes to get the taller one. So we started off with Petronas Towers, then we went over to Taipei 101, and then Shanghai is coming up here. If you see this quote, Shanghai World Financial Center will be the symbol. Okay, this is the key. It's not about money per se in the immediate instance. It's about symbolism. How to recreate your city to symbolically look like a world city. And nothing could be better, I suppose, than this. Of course, if you go to Taipei, you see this flat landscape and then this one building that goes up in the air. And it kind of tells you the opposite story. Global business hubs, it's a must now. Every city must have one or two. This is the most expensive one at the time. When I made this, it was $12 billion, but now it's $30 billion U.S. And all of the ground or the land assembly is government funded. It's not private sector, actually. It's a landfill. Corporate new towns, we have any kind, any number. And every city has them. Every big city has them. I'll show you what's inside of them. This is around Saigon, right? Saigon South. It's now being ringed by gigantic private towns, most of which, not all, are walled, have private police force, and are essentially managed, not governed. As I said before, you have a problem, you go to the management office. The manager's in Seoul. So the manager's in Taiwan, and they will make the arbitrary decision about whether or not to fix your pipes or whatever it is. And these are proliferating around the region. This is in Hanoi, around Hanoi. And this is what's inside of them, what's called simulacrum, or simulation, but simulacrum is a nice term. It's an exact copy of something that might never have existed. There's a little play going on here. So here you have, this is a place called Kota Wisata in Jakarta, and you have your choice of different lands, right? So I can buy into America land, and I'm going to get Statue of Liberty with cowboys and Indians running around. You see, they never really existed together, right? The Statue of Liberty and cowboys and Indians. But there they are in one space. Over the Australia line, you're going to get a kangaroo and maybe some boomerangs. I don't know what else. And of course, in China, many cities, they have their little worlds, right? So you get, I don't know how many copies of the Eiffel Tower there are. This one is something like half size, of course. You can go elsewhere and you see them right at your desk. I like this one. In the suburbs of Jakarta, you can live with the Sphinx. But what's common about all of these? There's no indigenous center. There's no Indonesia land. There's no Vietnam land. It's totally otherworldly. Flows over social encounters. This is very typical. The mega mall connected with the freeway. So you go from your gated community to the mega mall, you shop, you get back in your car, and you go home. You don't have to muck about in the chaos, quote unquote. No sidewalks, because who's going to walk? You're just going to drive to your house. And this is actually Petronas Towers. No place to sit, really. This is what's happening in Seoul. Seoul is kind of a leader in all of this. The government is quite active in promoting itself. This is the design by Zaha Hadid. She is the go-to starchitect who now is designing major of these kinds of things in cities throughout the world. She did not even come to Korea when she submitted her plan. She's so busy. And this is what it looks like inside. You can see over there. And it says here, will be a place where people and nature live in harmony. And the richness of history and culture fill the air. Has anyone ever read George Orwell? This is so Orwellian. It's up for you to judge, but here it is. This is it. This is the end game. In Korea it's called U-Town or Ubiquitous Town. Ubiquitous means everywhere, which in another book means nowhere. So imagine a town where everything could be taken care of at once within a single building complex. Think of what is Coex Mall. Coex Mall is one of the biggest malls in the world in Seoul, and it's all underground. Basically we're saying we're going to build a condo on top of the mall, and all of your life will just take place. Right? You just take the elevator down, you have a magic wand that does your shopping in advance, pizza, and I'm over there, my pizza's waiting. I don't need human interaction. I've already paid for it. I just pick it up. Think of two things I design a city. One is to make it a business. And the second is to get people to spend money so I make profit. They're the only two reasons to have a city. And guess what? These are being built. It's not fantasy. In Korea, they're now building new towns. To do it, you have to completely erase the old town because they have to fit it with wires and cables so that you can have all of this Wi-Fi stuff going on. I think one is being built in Beijing as well. And this is the kind of signage that you have to encounter when you're going around. It's all of this franchise city. I don't know. This is the end game of that. Has anyone ever seen Logorama, the animation? It won the Academy Award. This is Logorama's vision of contemporary Los Angeles. And when you see it, you go, it's true. Well, around the north end of Phong Khen Lake, there's this building. And if you see over time, all of the logos start to change to global franchise. And my main point would be any culturally vital place is going to have this colonization because you can appropriate the cultural value very cheaply by taking over a building next to it. So I think some of our Hanoi friends call this the KFC building now, I heard the other day, because that's the biggest sign on it. But even slums are not, or lower income places are not free. Gigantic Coca-Cola signs on the roof. And a coax mall, this is what you're going to see. And she even looks intimidated, right? Which is the intention. This is on the way from the airport from Hanoi. And this is a bottle of perfume, I think. Okay, so one of the biggest developments in Vietnam is Saigon South, Phu My Hung, and it's slated for wanted 1 million citizens. And in case you didn't know if you qualified, here's your photo. Can you find yourself among them? Some of my friends tell me that actually a lot of these people will never live there. They're just there for decoration because it's too expensive. This one, World Bank, American Institute of Planners, awards for the best cities in the world, best new cities in the world. It's totally private. And so I took pictures. This is downtown in the center of Ho Chi Minh City. This is average day in Phu My Hung. I think you can see some difference in the street life. There are no vendors allowed. There's no... It's across a new road from one of the most densely settled parts of the city. And that part of the city can never come into this. So what we're getting is a layering, and it's a fantastic new layering of built environment that's really only started about 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago. Suburban housing, new town, simulation, franchise, and all of these things are really transforming the city. But in addition to the transformation, it's also what I would call a corporatization. Private building that you can't go into, private places that you cannot enter, the selling of public land for private uses. So our plea is to make to save the public city. And one place to do that is to have more public spaces. And so we're looking for spaces that have these kinds of characteristics. I went very fast because we have a lot to do today. But if you have any quick questions, let me stop right now and ask you if you have any comments, anybody.
One of the big appeals of malls in Asia is that they're air-conditioned.
Yes,
So, you know, that's a kind of something that the old cities can't really replicate.
Well, you can cool an open market, a covered market, public market. That's not impossible. Yeah, that's true. And there's a novelty.
People just go there just to be cool rather than to enjoy the...
There are a lot of criticisms of the open or the public market. It's dirty, it's hot. But I think these are technical things that could be solved. The question is whether or not it's a public market.
Yeah, I take your argument. I'm just commenting.
Yeah. And, this is one more contentious thing. You know, I can talk about environment and all those things. And nobody, we got a bad environment, okay. But I talk about the shopping mall versus the public market, and here's where the fun starts. It's quite interesting. Anybody? Yes? Okay, well, as I said, part of our project here is to change the image of the city. So I'm going to ask Henry to give us a little talk on that.
Hey, thank you, Mike. And thank you to the Center for Southeast Asian Studies. We're really excited to be here and to collaborate and share what we've been doing in Vietnam and things with the image. And let me give you a little background. My name is Henry Mochida, and I started off in planning, and I wanted to add this crazy idea to do a film for my thesis. So my advisor said to take methodology classes in the Academy for Creative Media. I did, and I got absolutely hooked. I fell in love with filmmaking, and I almost didn't look back to planning. And it became this kind of back and forth argument with my mom about finishing my degree. And I eventually applied filmmaking to a topic and presented my thesis. And today, now, I'm really lucky to be back in planning under the mentorship of Professor Michael Douglas and other peers that are here. And I'm exploring through my studies how to use image and how it reflects knowledge and how it can shape the city. So I hope to share that with you today. And through our explorations of the image, we found that we had questions that needed answers. Questions like, why aren't films being used in academia? Because we saw the same research approaches being used. We were presenting knowledge. We were critically thinking. And the process is even similar to writing a paper, research paper. So we had questions like that to answer. And how would filmmaking and planning be different from visual ethnography or filmmaking? And in our current academic practices, why are we focused on the objective expert forms of knowledge? And what is this impact? And why not embrace also a subjective narrative approach to knowledge? So Mike guided us through looking beyond the towers, beyond the text and the image, and to really explore and try to reveal these underlying assumptions of what's being imaged and in academia. So through our classes, we offered this chance to pose these questions. We had two classes, Filmmaking for Social Research and Imaging the City. And Vera is here. She's a co-teacher with us. And we found how cinema came to shape the city. So I want to share this video.
York, the world's financial capital. Paris, the city of fashion and arts. Add their splendora in Vietnam, the heart of a new global lifestyle. Splendora will be remembered as a world-class city everyone would want to live in. It is where people and nature coexist in harmony. Splendora offers a life of perfect well-being that you dream of. Ecological Park will help you have a healthier life by enjoying sports facilities and breathing fresh air in the nature. If there is a life you have dreamed of, it will come true at Splendora. Beyond Vietnam and Asia, it is now born to a new complex city that the world will have an envious look. Your dream and your home. North An Khan Splendora.
So what we just saw was pretty much 100 years of the development of cinema. First going through as the spectacle of the camera, filming a city as an observational tool, but that quickly changed as the producers of cinema wanted to develop more audiences. So filmmakers started creating an illusion of reality, so using the city as a stage, as a backdrop. So it became more of a iconic presentation, and then eventually we have characters like King Kong climbing the Empire State Building, kind of giving it this skyscraper iconic identity to what a city is. And I think all of these historical things have influenced our today's value of cityscape. And our gaze became fixated upon these structures. So then we saw cinema transition into taking on more of a personification of the city. So we see these protagonistic characteristics, utopia, dystopia, happening, and cinema and the image came to kind of reflect our own values. So it came to start to symbolize how we see ourselves. And today, I know it's a big leap from Metropolis to that Splendora film, but really it's kind of about how the image has come to shape us instead. So we image this modern, appealing city, shiny architecture, and simulacra, but there's no identity there, and that's the danger. And so what we see is this commodification of the image. And our students, including ourselves, we produce films to offer alternative images to these sorts of images. And what we found in Southeast Asia was this corporate invasion of this form of image. So if you talk to people on the streets, they're beginning to desire the supermarket, the skyscraper, the air-conditioned shopping centers. And the image is everywhere. It's on those billboards from the airport. You're immediately bombarded by them. Pieces like Splendora. And Hanoi is certainly shifting. And so these images are basically digitally erasing our sense of place, our sense of history, and this physical destruction of memory is very devastating. And we have to remember the history of the city. And ironically, in our classes, Mike points out that this future city is always imaged in this way. It's linear, it's progressive, it's neoliberal, sterile, corporate vision of a city. It's technology, but there's no form of history in it. And it's really scary. And we see this happening all over the world. I was in Panama City filming a documentary. And when you come in from the airport to the city, the skyline just juts out of the Pacific. It's right on the Pacific Ocean. And this amazing skyline. And it looks like it's developing. There's skyscrapers silhouetted. But when you get closer, you notice that nothing's moving. There's no welding. The cranes are static. And even closer, you see the gaping mouths of unfinished concrete floors and rebar jutting out. And you realize that no one's there. The market crashed. This city didn't have a life. It went up and the finances ran out, and now everybody's gone, and whatever there was there before is gone forever. So it's this really scary scenario. So in talking about public space and public city, we should also be looking at what would a public image be. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Hal. And thank you for listening.
Thank you, everybody, especially the Center for Southeast Asian Study, for having me here today to give a presentation. So my part, I would like to, Mike already said that I can present, introduce something about Vietnam, about Hanoi, and kind of a transitioning from what's going on in the city, and then why the issue coming up in the our movie Dancing in the Park, to present a new alternative images of the city. And like Henry just said, he said that Hanoi is shifting, and in fact it is a city with a thousand years in with a tradition and in the history. To celebrate it is the millennium, to last October. But now it's huge, tremendously transformed. And I would like to show you that how largely you got to look at the scale and you visually see that the transformation of the city. Before we move to the our movie showing that the public life of the city. So, everybody may know that the city, the national reform in Vietnam, just launched in 1986, but actually it is effective earliest really since 1990. So for the past decade, the people in Vietnam, they really, really see the improvement, right? They see the development, quote unquote, through the erection of a lot of high buildings, new towns, urban development areas. And of course, the living standard getting much better. They have more goods and more commodities and services are available, and then the global franchise come. They can export to the global markets now, but the most obvious form is the all the high rise buildings they see every day. The cities in Vietnam become a massive construction site with a lot of projects. So, in Hanoi, recently in May 19, 2008, the Parliament, the Congress, and the government of Vietnam adopted a resolution to expand Hanoi from around its boundary become a four times larger than the old administrative boundary I'm going to show later on. So the development, they perceive that the development of the city, the expansion of the city is going to give them more land for the development. They don't focus much on the quality of life and the city life, but actually they want to have more land for the development. And you can see here it just shows the dramatic and intensive changes in the especially in the peri-urban, because the development of the city is the encroachment of the city to the periphery. With all especially Hanoi has surrounded by many traditional craft villages. So the expansion of Hanoi really imposed certain negative impacts on the development, the weather of those villages, and the question is whether they can preserve their own culture, everything, given the fact that land price will be increased. So you see some image, construction everywhere, inside the city and even in the periphery of the city. Surprisingly, they still allow a lot of high-rise building inside the city, in the inner city. Even the fact that Hanoi already is very packed city. GSOZ, the formal statistics number saying is city population around 6-7 million. In fact, it's almost like 9 or 10 million people with the immigrants. People come to the city every year around 400,000. So they have a lot of plans. I would like to go through several major plans that, that show that the scale of development of the city. New city proposed to be constructed along the Red River is one of them, proposed by collaboratively proposed between the Hanoi government and the Seoul government of Korea. They try to build, they want to imitate the development of Han River, and they build something similar in the Red River of Hanoi. And here are some, this is a satellite image of the, this is the Red River. And they want to develop, to build a new city along the river side. Yes, and they would like to copy the model of Seoul. So the rapid development of the city can be seen through the, like, for the only one decade, more than 150 new urban development, housing development projects, including a new town like Mai already present, and some proposal to build Splendora, Tiputra. And of course, public transportation system keep being upgraded, and the whole city becomes a massive construction site. This is it used to be the city of Lex, with a less dense population city, and now today you see this is what people describe about Hanoi. It has the how do you say it, that kind of, what form of the architecture?
Vernacular
architecture. 90% housing in Vietnam, almost 90% built by people themselves, without street. Recently they have a law, but without street supervision enforcement from the government. So here exactly, this is the old Hanoi. And since May 2008, it's just become that large. The population doesn't increase much, but look at the boundary, it's almost 3 times larger than the original size. And they plan to build, it has a major center here. This is the proposed master plan of the city right now, prepared by an alliance between corporate POSCO in Korea and American
architects.
So they want to build a major urban center and 5 satellite cities, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 3 ecological centers, cities, 1, 2, 3, and around 10 urban town and in the rural region. This is a new plan for the city of Hanoi.
So Splendor is one of these.
The Splendor is one of these. And it just shows the green corridor development strategy. And because the fact is, in many, many new urban development areas, new town in Vietnam, they don't create enough public space for people. So for the everyday life purposes, for social interaction among the residents, and thus this is what the in the new plan the developer and they convene the Vietnamese government and Vietnamese people that, well, we're gonna save 70% of land for the green corridor, that enough will be good to make Hanoi become an ecological, like, become friendly, environmental friendly city, and enough space for people. It's gonna be some image of how in the master plan of Hanoi, by 2030 and the vision to 2050. This one, they want to turn a 1,000-year city become to something very modern. And then, like Henry said, that and already Mike said, there's a trend of privatization of the city, and then they want to build something new. They want to erase what the existing situation, because they cannot wait to be a capitalist in Vietnam. So everybody want to live in the. They claim what's going on outside is very chaotic, very messy. And then they want to live in the privatized house and with better off labor, and they want their own privacy, and they don't care about the rest of the society of the city, which is, as I said, very chaotic. That's why they want to move. People cannot wait to live in somewhere like this. Cannot wait to experience the modern view, the civilization. That's what's going on in the cities, in the major city of Vietnam right now, like in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City. But now we're going to show you the other part of the city. It shows the social life, how people interact, and how Hanoi can last for 1,000 years.
Great. So we don't want to set this up too much, because the movie should speak for itself. But you'll see it's a different image of the city. It's an image that the people themselves are giving us.
Chúng tôi năm nay tổ chức thế là lần đầu cho với lại kỷ niệm 1.000 năm, nó nằm trong cái quần thể.
Vỉa hè rất đặc trưng, tại vì ở Việt Nam thì cái chuyện người ta tồn tại những cái sinh hoạt bên vỉa hè là rất là nhiều, và những cái chợ tạm ấy, những cái chợ mà nó được phát sinh do cái nhu cầu tức thời của cái người dân sinh sống tại cái khu vực đấy, và cái nhu cầu sinh hoạt của người ta nó cần tồn tại một cái không gian giao tiếp, đấy là cái không gian công cộng. Thế thì không nên coi đó là một cái văn hóa gì ở mức độ thấp, đấy là một cái nét văn hóa.
Tất cả mọi nơi, chứ không phải là cùng một phố hay gì cả, cứ bạn bè ra đây gặp nhau thì là vui vẻ. Bây giờ ra đây chỉ có vui vẻ thôi, sáng người ta thì họ muốn là vui vẻ lấy tiếng lấy xong về.
Còn ở Bắc đằng này gần hơn chỗ đầu đằng này và đằng kia một tí thì là có một lớp dậy nhảy,
một là cái nhóm ở chỗ này, ở đây mà chỗ kia đi tiếp xuống dưới kia cũng mấy nhóm nữa, đâu khoảng 10-11 nhóm đấy. Rồi bên này là bên kia đông lắm.
Thank you. bên này, chân ta chân kia, chân này, chân này.
Tôi học lâu rồi, học lâu rồi đến đây để tập thể dục và ôn lại và tìm bạn gái.
Ở trên tôi dạy cái đây là 5 năm. Lúc đầu chỉ là ra chơi và giúp đỡ mọi người, nhưng mà do mọi người yêu cầu để mà hiệu quả tốt hơn thì là ta mở thành lớp.
Để lâu lâu không biết tên nhưng mà họ biết mặt nhau không được bộ, nhưng mà không biết tên. Còn tên thì biết là như thế này.
Nói chung là cái nhảy này nó luôn mang niềm vui cho mọi người. Thế thì có những kỷ niệm như vậy là Dương học thì trời mưa. Thế nhưng mà ngoài người không muốn để tán tại vì Dương Nam.
Thế là vào buổi sáng ở chỗ gần nguồn nước thì có mấy lớp aerobic rất là hay. Các chị đang tập aerobic ở đấy.
Câu lạc bộ này là câu lạc bộ công sức khỏe ngoài trời, công viên thống nhất được lấy tên là như vậy. Trước đây là công viên Lenin, bây giờ là công viên thống nhất. Thế mà câu lạc bộ này hình thành từ năm 1973. Đấy. Thế và tồn tại đến bây giờ là 37 năm rồi.
Thế còn cái công viên này trước đây thì nó không có gì cả. Mà nói là mà chúng tôi là cái hồi chúng tôi nó có 16, 17 tuổi thôi. Thì ra đây để đào cái hồ ở đây, hồ này. Thế là đào hồ ở đây để mấy lúc bây giờ mới xây công viên. Rồi mới trồng cây chứ trước đây là không có.
Ai cũng phải đến, tôi cũng đã từng đến đây để đào đất rồi, xong rồi khinh vác nhau này đắp lên chỗ này cao chỗ kia thấp này.
Bọn tôi cùng tham gia mà. Thế là có thể là đào đất cùng lao động. Cái hồi đó là nó có phong trào lao động theo chủ nghĩa, tức là tất cả mọi người đều phải
học
thanh niên, học sinh thanh niên. Đấy, nhất là đoàn viên thanh niên là đi nhiều.
Cái sự lao động xã hội chủ nghĩa ở đây là của cả cán bộ công nhân viên và nhân dân của cả ba miền Bắc Trung Nam, cho nên đặt cái tên của mình không biết.
Cái khu vực này trước đấy thì bị rào lại rất khoảng vài năm mà mọi người cũng rất là băn khoăn không biết đấy là rào lại để làm gì. Cho đến sau đấy thì em có đọc được một cái tin ở trên báo nói rằng là người ta đã phải sợ công một cái khách sạn ở trong khu vực này, và cái việc đào móng đã làm tràn lan bùn ra cái khu hồ này và cho mọi người rất là khó khăn. Thì lúc đấy em mới biết là ta xây cái trại đây, hay để đi đến cho đến lúc mà thông tin được về và chị và thì công trình đã được xây dựng. Thực ra thì cái vấn đề này hình như là đã được chính quyền thành phố thảo luận và xem xét, và sau đấy thì họ tổ chức một cuộc họp báo.
Hà Nội có một cuộc họp riêng, thì cái cuộc họp đó bao gồm rất là nhiều người, bao gồm có cả cái công ty mà làm chủ dự án này, bao gồm các cái hội nghề nghiệp, bao gồm các quan chức, bao gồm cả chủ tịch của thành phố Hà Nội nữa. Thì ngày hôm đó thì cái ông chủ tịch thành phố Hà Nội làm một việc là ông ấy nghe tất cả ý kiến của các bên.
Thì thấy ý kiến của tôi là thấy như thế, không nên xây dựng cái công viên là cái khu khách sạn 5 sao hay 7 sao gì đó, cũng không nên.
Sân này sân tự do, để trong nhà.
Để đây nó là lá phổi của thành phố. Cả cái thành phố Hà Nội thì chỉ có chỗ này và là cái chỗ mà để cho các cụ vui chơi giải trí và nâng cao sức khỏe và tuổi thọ.
Đây là cái chỗ chơi của mọi người. Nếu mà xây khách sạn thì chỉ phục vụ một số người thôi. Cái đó là mà đây nó là công thức của ngày xưa rất nhiều người. Đây phải là một cái điểm mà là cung cấp để phục vụ mọi người.
Thì có những ý kiến nói rằng là chúng ta phải thực hiện dự án này.
Tôi có liên hệ với cả bên hội kiến trúc, hội quy hoạch đô thị Việt Nam. thì các bác thì rất là nhiệt tình. Khi mà tôi vừa đưa vấn đề ra một cái thì các bác đều bảo là ôi chuyện này thì không thể xảy ra được, bởi vì là khu những cái khu công cộng ở Việt Nam, khu công cộng dành cho vui chơi dành cho người dân ở Việt Nam nên ngày càng bị thu hẹp dần. Nếu mà mình cứ để cái chuyện này tiếp diễn thì sẽ rất là nhiều mảnh đất khác sẽ bị mất đi.
Chứ không thể để cho một vài các cái chủ đầu tư hay đối tượng nào khai thác với mục đích kinh doanh.
Và đặc biệt là diễn ra một cuộc tranh luận rất là sôi nổi và thu hút được rất là nhiều sự chú ý và tham gia của người dân trên mạng internet, trên diễn đàn của Vietnamnet.
Và sức cùng lên tiếng để yêu cầu là phải trả lại công viên cho người dân. Thì đến Thủ tướng Nguyễn Tân Dũng nói là dừng lại.
Cái không gian công cộng, một cái thành phố đô thị muốn trở thành một đô thị thân thiện thì phải có những không gian công cộng.
Thì vì vậy nên là bây giờ nếu mà thu hẹp lại những công viên đi thì nó sẽ không hay. Với cái sự tồn tại của nó từ xưa đã có thì tôi muốn nghĩ là cái giữ nguyên được cái thể trạng, cái diện tích cũ của nó càng rộng ra thì là cái nơi càng tốt hơn.
Trong cái này thôi chứ hàng nghìn người đi xung quanh đây, hàng nghìn trên nghìn người chứ không biết không
được gì. Chúng tôi chỉ mong muốn là
duy trì và không bỏ đi,
duy trì được như thế này và mỗi một ngày nó được một đẹp lên, xanh tươi đẹp hơn. Đấy
là yêu nước mà đất đây được tập trung
công viên thật đẹp và đông người mà
ông thích công viên
các cô đến nữa tuyệt vời.
Chồng thích các cô thích lắm.
Taking life at home. Our colleagues in Hanoi posted on YouTube, so now it's going wherever it wants to go. But one of the main ideas that we're going to follow through is our colleague Mike DeGroy is going to come here. We're going to repurpose these films, a number of films, which means we, you know, they're short, 10 minutes. Put a teaching module around it with readings, talking points, and that, and then try to give it to universities or schools that can use it. And there are a number of people in Hawaii that are interested in kind of getting a whole range of these things together. There's Best Press, I don't know if you know these people, yeah, or, and others. So one is to intentionally repurpose it so it can be an educational
thing.
Yeah, we also have a website called Hanoi Public City that we have curators of different themes, and so they're managing. It varies throughout, but it's available online, and it's posted on that as well.
do you get any sense that this is influencing policy making in Hanoi at all? Or, I mean, it's too early yet, probably.
Well, it's an interesting question. For the first 3 or 4 years when I was going to Vietnam, I was always facing the policy makers, facing the academics. Now I'm trying to turn around and face the people, so to speak. So the photo contest was really to say, okay, citizens, you contribute. And here's a film, you're in it. We're going to go next month. We're going to actually show this film to the people around the city. And in that way, it's more my own personal odyssey in life is more to reach towards civil society. Now, NGOs are legal in Vietnam, and they are appearing. So there's a whole sector that's just emerging. They yearn for ideas. They yearn for a reimagining of the city. So we hope we can contribute to that.
In the meantime, because of, as you know, the Vietnam is also a country, and the government is very strong in terms of enforcing and the idea and the in the agenda in general. Last time when we was in Hanoi and we had just a meeting, an informal meeting, more than 100 people showed up, all the journalists and the NGO people, they want to see something alternative, some alternative viewpoint and approach and in the agenda. And my told people that there's three different ways you may want to say, three different ways you want. Either you follow what the government tells you to do, you oppose it, but to do that, you're going to feel, sometimes you feel like daunting because or tired of it, because that the global forces keep pushing, and look at the Thống Nhất Park is one successful story, but if, you know, like, and right now people propose to build a huge parking lot in there right now. So it keep come back, right? It keep come back because it's just a very lucrative area that to get profit. So if you keep opposing, you may feel, you know, you quit sometimes. But the third is you can propose new alternative to the government. You don't oppose it, but you show that the alternative would be better than you like go to the table with the discussion. Debate, negotiation, whatever. But that's why he said that he switched approach, not to the policymaker anymore. Now we focus on the people and the journalists and NGO people. Those people right now, they start voicing and giving comments and all the input to the government policy.
It was quite heartening. That event was spontaneous. It was only organized a day or so before, but by journalists. And so it's about 100 people showed up. I gave that presentation. I just gave basically that one. And it was in the press. It was on TV. It was just everywhere because of this yearning for some idea that could be a counterpoint. And it really was quite surprising in a very heartening way. Yes?
The question about the film, which I thought was quite interesting and charming in the way it was presented, but there are no young people. Do you have film footage with like kids and with
you missed it? They were there.
I guess I didn't see it.
You didn't see the little kids?
Yeah, they're running on those on the street.
To answer your question a little different way, all of this takes place between 6 and 8 a.m. And interestingly enough, before the park opens, because when it opens, it becomes socialist, and you get music, one song blaring over the entire park, and all the officially designated groups can use it. Okay, but you also get lovers, and you get couples that want to be together. It's amazing, and this is during the daytime. Right? So they're different. Actually, someone in Scandinavia or somewhere did a daytime, hour by hour, inventory of what goes on. And you see all the age groups where they come at different times. But in fact, we were kind of careful to make sure that every age group was represented in that film. And if you look at it again, you'll see that. So, but that's a typical, when I presented this in Singapore being Singapore, I guess one of the younger people said, well, the parks for the old people, the shopping centers for us. How do I deal with that one? By the way, the critique is in the background of this film, because I've decided that if you show 75% of the positive, what we really want to show is the joy of using the spaces. You'll be convinced about the other 25%. But if it's all just, griping about the new stuff, it's not going to go over. So we really want to show the light on these people. The fellow who stamps his foot, he's 78 years old. And he bicycles every day from his house to this park to dance for those 1 or 2 hours. And he told us, if it weren't for the park, I'd be dead. Simply dead. And it's not just a physical exercise, it's the social engagement. It's really crazy. So, yeah, but why not? If we just had older people, why not? I mean, it's an aging society, too. And that segment of society is getting bigger and bigger. With really in one of the most crowded cities in the world, if you look at housing, the public space is absolutely vital and shrinking. Yeah. Yes,
I had two thoughts. One was something about the correlation of the franchises, the KFCs, and ballroom dancing also being a franchise in a way that there's a relationship. But then I had a question, and that was, in all of your interviews, did you see any relationship between the design and architecture of the park and the public space and the styles of dance that were being done there? Were they reflecting one another in any way? Were they calling for certain kinds of styles of dance to come into that space?
Okay, the first point you have to explain more, because I don't see the franchise part of the dancing at all. This is totally spontaneous. They bring their own music.
I was thinking about the import of ballroom dance.
Outsiders often think about that way, but people in Vietnam, I don't think, see this as a foreign invasion. It's in that sense. I know it's kind of, if you're a kind of post-colonialist, you'll see here comes the West invading. It's not quite, in my humble observation, I don't think that's really what's going on.
Traditional dancing, they have designated like the club, right? So like young people or of course old people, they didn't go there then. It's not like Hawaiian have one, the old people still do hula. In Vietnam, the traditional very much they become like they have club to do that inside, not do that outside. But you can see that the old ladies, they have the open air health club been there since 1973. So it's around 30 years they've been there doing that. And the ballroom dancing, because people to do exercise, they take it as doing exercise, they have a chance to go to interact with people, to meet with friends. And then they want to do something else. And I agree with Mike, I don't see that as kind of like Western culture invasion, the Vietnamese culture. It doesn't mean that the traditional type of dancing will be disappear or will not be practiced somewhere else. It's a practice at right moment for them, that because of space, it's so easy to bring the radio cassettes, a couple of the music, and turn on. And okay. Everybody enjoy. The great thing is, it's open to everyone. No fee. You join. And then some people, it's very voluntary. You can pay for like 50 cents for the music. But it's totally voluntary, and even one of the
principal people is from Taiwan.
Professor from Taiwan, he walk in and dance with the gentleman.
Very inclusive. And there are no billboards saying come and do ballroom dancing or join the club. It's interesting too to get more detail in a very prosaic way. If you don't want to pay the fee, you can stand a little further away.
This is aerobic, right? The lady.
Yeah. If you go to the Tai Po Park, for example, around the lake, you'll see there's the woman with the boombox, and everyone's around here. And then across the street, there's people going, and they're doing it.
It does strike me that these open spaces and heavy, densely populated places like Hanoi and other urban places where there's massive influx of people coming looking for work become a vacuum. Because they have that space, and then it becomes as crowded as other parts of the the city. If you get to where you have people playing badminton and the soccer ball is rolling out in between their court, and right here you have the dancers, and even that experience is really packed together. So I wonder about that influx of people from outside into the cities, and you know, will there be an end to that, or will it just keep packing in where open space then becomes closed?
I think if you were an anarchist, you'd be quite in favor of this, because it really is self-organized. People do not start fist fights over the badminton shuttle getting in their way. It's very civilized, and people really get along in the park in a most amazing way. I'm thinking about American parks. We usually go with our group, and we're hermetically sealed, right? It's my barbecue, and we might invite a stranger occasionally. But this is totally open to anybody. Anyone can dance. Anyone can do the aerobics. And then you kind of work out the borders between it. It's not that crowded, though. It's a huge park. And you were asking the other question. The dancing actually takes place, as long as it's flat, it can take place in many places. There's some in earth cover under the trees, and other was more in a paved area. It's kind of where you can find the room for it. But just to emphasize, this is an iconic park. This is a park that was built by the people. It's historic, and cultural meaning is huge. So it's not just the ordinary park that the city government built. This is a park built with the labor of people who are still alive and can remember doing that. We have some Hanoians in our room with you. So to assault that park without announcing it, suddenly you're constructing a 5-star hotel in the middle of it, is a pretty shocking event. And I think that's probably why went to the top of government. It went beyond the local government. If it had saved the local government, probably it wouldn't have been stopped. This is my view. It had to go very high up. But it's how I was saying, it's like water going down, always trying to find the crevice. So before this, there was a plan to have a Disneyland kind of thing in there. That was quickly stopped. Then the hotel, and that was already under construction, that got stopped. And now, this year, is a 5-story parking garage that's going to be in. So it's kind of unrelenting, never vigil. Hal mentioned, by the way, that having an alternative is important. So in these meetings that were taking place to then approach government to stop the hotel construction, one of the elements was to find alternative places for the hotel. And this turned out to be tactically really important, because the hotel came up, well, we have no place else to go. Oh, yes, you do. And they named those places. It really deflated their entire argument, because you were prepared with, we will still accommodate you, but not in the park. Meanwhile, just for the record, the hotel builders, a fake company that pretends it's Scandinavian, but it's actually in Singapore, has sued the government of Vietnam for $70 million, even though their sunk cost was $16 million, and even that's inflated. So kind of the nerve. They were caught red-handed, basically, faking their identity, because old Scandinavian Air Service, STS, had special relationship through the Scandinavian government's nice friendship with Vietnam through all the years of animosity. And the company dies, it gets bought out, and it ends up in a Singapore company, which then uses SAS as the logo, claiming the right that was actually given to another entity. And that wasn't really the name of the company anyway. So that's how they got into this scene. Otherwise, probably wouldn't have been allowed in principle. So all of these micropolitics, this is why I do this kind of thing, by the way. The micro spaces of cities, spaces that you can just see the whole world through them, just right in that spot. And I think film is one way really to show you. You're all watching it in a different way, I'm sure, getting different messages, which is really great. And we've seen much more in a film than you would see in a written paper. Not that there's anything wrong with the ribbon paper. Okay. So, anyone else?
Yeah, I just want to thank everybody. You guys are doing really excellent and groundbreaking work in developing this kind of material and then thinking to take it even further as an educational tool. And I really think that this is the future, or a section of education as it will play out over the very distant, very near future.
Thank you. Thanks all. Thank you, everybody.
Mahalo for listening to the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Speaker Series podcast. If you'd like to download, comment on, or share this podcast, as well as subscribe to our weekly announcement listserv, please visit us at csehashawaii.com.